My name is Michael McCusker. Before I get into the main gist of the program, I'd like to celebrate Independence or Liberty Day yesterday with a poem written by a friend of mine about Tiananmen Square. It has been 23 years, 1 month, and 1 day since June 4th, 1989, when Chinese troops shot into the Chinese students. And my friend Michael Horowitz, aka V.O. Blum, I always said that was his nom de plume, wrote a poem that summer of 1989, I beg your pardon, in tribute to the Chinese students who protested their tyrannical regime and were attacked in the square by soldiers and tanks. Many were killed, wounded, and or arrested. Some might remember the famous photograph of a man who stopped a line of Chinese tanks by standing in front of them. The poem also commemorates the appearance of the Goddess of Liberty in Tiananmen Square, which was a homemade sculpture, probably made of plaster or papier-mâché. And this is the poem, written in 1989. In tribute, the Goddess of Liberty. There she was, in the square, lifting her torch above the crowd, leading scholars against tyranny. Her frozen likeness guards New York, but she was last seen in action in the streets of Paris in the uprising of 1830, and immortalized by Delacroix, Liberty guiding the people. Our romance was in Mexico in the late 1930s, where Rosa had gone to help Cardenas, but the news was bad. Guernica, Munich, and she began drinking at noon. I left the morning she confused me with Trotsky. Yet I never worried about her. When your politics are as good as hers, angels pay your rent. It was good to see you, Rosa, raising hell in China. And that was V.O. Blum, aka Michael Horowitz, in 1989. He is co-publisher of Times Eagle Books and the author of Split Creek, Equator, The Story and the Letters, and Sunbelt Stories. And I believe he still might be the president of Tonga University, which at the time he claimed the world's smallest university with a student body of 12, though he told me that he raised it up to 20 the last time I talked with him, I believe. Well, today is Bloody Thursday. And parenthetically, it's also the birthday of Rita Smith, who's unashamedly devoted to dogs and to the welfare of animals. So happy birthday, Rita. But Bloody Thursday has come to mean the 1934 Pacific Coast Maritime Strike. And I'd like to write something I wrote about it. So this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire universe, along with Mike Quinn, whom I quote rather liberally from his book, The Big Strike. Bloody Thursday. The mainstream mediocrities have lately saturated the American public with the anniversary of June 6th of D-Day, the Allied invasion from England, and Adolf Hitler's Festung Europa, and also, of course, Independence Day, the 4th of July. Perhaps we should glance inward a trifle and take account of an anniversary that commemorates a bloody battle which occurred during the lopsided and never-ending labor wars in this country. Today, July 5th, is the anniversary of Bloody Thursday, the most violent day of the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934. And I believe this makes it the 48th anniversary. 48 years ago this summer, I beg your pardon, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934 when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores, as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Portland, Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought bitter pitched battles with guns and clubs arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of shipowners, presidents of stevedoring companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 70th anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4 holiday provided a truce, and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike, and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m. promptly, the police went into action, Quinn wrote. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys off the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Quinn quoted a newspaper. The hottest battle took place in front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewardship Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors. Quinn wrote that workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. Police charged into the Seaboard Hotel, Quinn continued, where many strikers were quartered and drove all occupants into the streets, swinging their long riot sticks and cracking skulls right and left. The building was filled with gas and riddled with pistol fire. Stubbornly holding their ground and fighting every inch of the way, the strikers were driven back into the city and off the Embarcadero. The battle swept over into the busy downtown district, endangering crowds of pedestrians. One picket, striker, entrenched himself in a parking lot, devised a crude slingshot from an old inner tube, and began bombarding Chief of Police William J. Quinn's, no relation to Quinn the writer, car with bricks. It took a barrage of tear gas and pistol fire to dislodge him. Scores of men littered the sidewalks, either lying silently or crawling away painfully on their hands and knees. A woman alighting from a streetcar at the ferry building screamed and collapsed when a bullet struck her in the temple. A man rushed to her assistance, was struck by another bullet, and crumpled to the street beside her. A Chronicle reporter described women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the Loop to step into an inferno with screaming children clinging to them. They disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls. Smothered and blinded by gas, the women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital, where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping with blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. And that was Quinn quoting the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle. And he continues in his own text. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray shots as they fled. At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriman had said earlier: "You refuse to arbitrate, now take the consequences." Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. The striking unions had men detailed to the hospitals to see that wounded pickets received adequate attention when brought in from the battlefield. These men reported later that injured strikers were threatened and intimidated by police when they stated that their club and gunshot wounds were caused by officers. At the close of the day, Acting Governor Merriman ordered the National Guard onto the waterfront. 2,000 troops marched into the area equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles. By the time they arrived, the fighting had ceased and the pickets had been driven from the embarcadero. The guardsmen posted themselves at intervals down the whole length of the waterfront and mounted machine guns on the roofs of piers. Troops marched in wearing steel helmets and full service equipment. They set up camp inside the long covered docks, established field kitchens, and remained there under wartime conditions. Divisions were brought in from Santa Rosa, Napa, Petaluma, Gilroy, and other outlying towns. Rumors were abundant to the effect that certain units had refused service, but strict censorship was maintained and definite confirmations were lacking. All day long, newspapers uptown had been pouring out extra after extra, delivering veritable hourly reports from the line of battle. Wailing sirens careening up and down Market Street aroused speculation and alarm among the public. The word blood, blood, blood recurred every three or four lines in every news story. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily, as they typed their copy. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. And all of that was a quote from Quinn and his book, The Big Strike. On Monday, July 9th, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast the length of Market Street behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava, solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads. Overhead, a brilliant sun in a cloudless sky. Another newspaper said that the two dead strikers, quote, in life, would not have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors in newspapers claimed that a communist army was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. 500 extra policemen were hired and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police red squads raided strikers' homes and union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers that they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934, and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted for more than 2 years, ultimately resulting in the whole Pacific Coast maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever. And that was Quinn. The Great Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, and it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. The 1934 strike is memorable because, above all, it demonstrated the power latent in the rank and file, Harry Bridges said a few years later. The rank and file not only manned the picket lines and did the sacrificing, as it must in every strike, but it also made the big decisions and determined the strategy. The rank and file would not be bulldozed or buffaloed, browbeaten or divided, and therefore it could not be licked. Once it knew the score, the rank and file could not be misled by any phony labor leader or panicked by any barrage of newspaper propaganda. Bridges said that, ultimately, the power of any union that serves as an instrumentality of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is one fundamental truth that has not altered since 1934, nor will it alter in time to come. We've had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Bridges said, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the two dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that every July 5th there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed. No one authorizes the July 5th holiday, accepting a 100% accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it and 2 years after his death at age 41. Therefore, Quinn wrote, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellow documents of the Revolution of 1776, which reads, by the consent of the governed. And that was Bloody Thursday, a part of which I wrote and much of which I quoted from Mike Quinn's book, The Big Strike. Now I'd like to read The Streamlined Strike by James M. Jones, who was in his 80s and living in Seal Rock, Oregon, when he sent this article to my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle. And he died, I believe, in the late 1990s. I'm going to read as much as I can of this. But this is about the strike that replaced the 34 strike when the shippers all broke their promises. And a quote beginning with Harry Bridges, a communist is any worker who wants a nickel more than the boss is willing to pay. The Streamlined Strike by James Jones, M. Jones. I was in Los Angeles during 1934, and I remember San Pedro at the time of Bloody Thursday. The port had a cordon with roadblocks set up by the police, the sheriff's department, and the stormtroopers from the L.A. Red Squad. It was a time of hunger march caravans from all over California by truck and jalopy. I was on a truck which ran the San Pedro blockade one night with a load of produce for the strikers. Our Relief Workers Protection Union gave our stale bread, canned goods, and vegetables. I moved to San Francisco at the end of 1935 when the stories of the shootings by police and the National Guard and their midnight raids on workers' homes were still fresh. I became acquainted with some of the people who had been terrorized by the police. The workers of the waterfront who had been treated like bums and derelicts by ship owners and stevedoring companies rebounded fast. They and the Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, ILWU, abolished the shape-up random method of hiring hungry men and won a few cents an hour increase. I remember well the great march up Market Street with contingents from all of San Francisco's unions marching 20 abreast in memory of Bloody Thursday. They were proud, strong, disciplined, and fire. 32 Clay Street was half a step from San Francisco's waterfront by the ferry building in the middle of the waterfront. It was a sturdy three-story building where the offices of most maritime unions clustered. Something more than the usual rumble and bustle of cargo carts and trucks hurrying their loads to and from the docks echoed around 32 Clay Street in the fall of 1936. Just converted into the Union Recreation Center by the Maritime Federation of the Pacific, 32 Clay Street was about to become a bulwark of all the West Coast maritime unions, a central clearinghouse. And the MFP was forged in the heat of the ferocious 34 maritime strike. Only 2 years before the Union Recreation Center opened was the great strike of the maritime unions and the San Francisco General Strike in 1934. Then shipowners and their allies ran droves of strikebreakers into the waterfront to try to crush the new maritime unions. Thousands of police armed with pistols and rifles backed up the strikebreakers, wounded many of the union pickets around the docks, and killed two of them. Pitched battles between union pickets on one side and strikebreakers and police on the other continued. Soon the governor tried to break the strike by sending in 5,000 National Guardsmen onto the waterfront embarcadero. This flood of guardsmen moved in tanks and set up light artillery and machine guns to do battle with the striking union men. Uptown, further terror was unleashed against union members, with middle-of-the-night raids by police and vigilantes on homes and union headquarters. Now, in 1936, the contracts between the unions and the employers signed in 1934 were about to run out. Steamship owners, stevedoring, barging, and tug companies were lined up by the Uptown Industrial Association to present a solid front to the unions. The unions were well aware of these preparations to smash them. They set up their own strike machinery under the banner of the Maritime Federation of the Pacific. Would this new struggle be like the Battle of 1934? Something important was happening to me also. The year before, I had spent in the San Joaquin Valley, the Valley of the Grapes of Wrath, trying to rally agriculture workers. The grape, fruit, and cotton pickers who were constantly harassed and attacked by vigilantes and police. A sad, hopeless job to find a chance to organize these destitute and terror-ridden migrant workers to get them to fight against their misery. Now, on the San Francisco waterfront, I was to be in the very midst of an impending battle for union survival and for work conditions above those of expendable drudge animals. I got a job at the Union Recreation Center, responsible for the gymnasium and for basketball. In the midst of committee activity, the coming and going of picket squads, I organized basketball games, an intramural league, and a team to represent the Union Recreation Center in the City League. These men were sailors, longshoremen, ship scalers, bargemen, inland boatmen, marine firemen, cooks and stewards, commercial fishermen, the spectrum of union men from the maritime industry. Pacific Coast longshoremen made up 17,000 of the 40,000 members of the Maritime Federation. They were shoreside and a relatively stable core of the Federation, so if their union could be smashed or at least weakened, the rest of the maritime unions would not be too hard to handle. This was the strategy of the employers. The strike had not officially begun when I arrived to take up my job at the Union Recreation Center, but it was a beehive of activity. Here, picketing was organized, committees met, and discussions begun in union meetings as to the best way to conduct the strike. The hum of preparation foretold efficient strike machinery and enthusiasm from the Central Strike Committee on down. Soon, seamen were piling off ships so fast it began to look like the cohesiveness of the many unions that made up the Maritime Federation was endangered by too precipitous strike action. Near the end of a 15-day extension of the 2-year-old agreements between unions and employers, there was a mass meeting of all the maritime unions, with Harry Bridges and Harry Lundberg speaking. Lesser leaders and the rank and file had their say also. Bridges told the huge throng of maritime workers, "Yes, we are fed up with conditions, and I know that you want to get moving with the strike, but let's remember this." He paused, ran his thin, sharp face with its wide-open blue eyes over the great crowd, eager and electric. He emphasized each word. Remember, the ship owners are going to force a shutdown of shipping, but they are attempting to make the public think that the maritime unions desire a strike, that we are the cause of the shutdown. We won't have pork chops for a while, but we longshoremen will not go back to the shape-up, and the seamen will not go back to Fink Hall, hiring like picking bums off the street, or in an office run by shipowner agents. And that was Bridges. In negotiations, the shipowners and other waterfront employers tried to play off one union against the other, and the big press helped them with one-sided publicity. They garbled the news of what was happening in negotiations. The employers became the good guys who were faced with pig-headed workers. Responsible union leaders kept emphasizing the need to keep public support for the unions. The strike publicity committee sweated to get correct strike information to the public. Then the union members voted for a second 15-day extension of the old employer-union agreements. Memories of the strike breaking, the terrorism of the police, vigilantes, and National Guard 2 years before were fresh. The union's publicity committee continued yeoman work so the people in general could begin to see what it was the shipowners who were stalling a settlement, that it was them who were stalling a settlement. Their strategy of starve them out in a protracted shutdown of all maritime industry was emerging. And who were these maritime workers who fought to be treated like human beings? They were the native-born, but probably more than 50% of them had come across the oceans in search of a better life in America, and now they had to fight for it. At the end of October, union bargemen, longshoremen, black gang, masters, mates, scalers, and fishermen held a general referendum. The second 15-day extension of the old contract was about to run out. These 40,000 members of the Maritime Federation voted 95% in favor of a general strike. The big press and radio, at the behest of the employers, screamed that the struggle for life by the unions was a communist plot. However, the strike committee got the news to the public as to what was really taking place, making it clear that the employers were stalling. They used their own radio printed broadsides, and they broke through to some radio stations with press releases. The strike rolled on through November. The other West Coast ports from San Diego to Canada were now shut down solid. At about this time, the mariners of the East Coast and Gulf Coast came out on strike in support of the West Coast. Members of the strike committees became more than fellow committee members. They became family friends, and they shared what they had as reserves shrank. Uptown friends still working used their bank accounts to help. The maritime workers were proving that they could reorganize their lives in a thorough battle for survival. Some people were amazed at how well they could run their own show on the waterfront without the employers. In admiration for the smooth functioning of the strike, it came to be called the streamlined strike. By December, it was clear that the employers were losing the war for public opinion. In desperation, they agreed to a public debate between Bridges and their best speaker, a shipping company president. Sleek, florid-faced, Roger Lampham was a bold and clever talker. The place of the debate was the Civic Auditorium. And Bridges, who wound up the debate, I'm jumping over a couple of paragraphs, with sharply incisive words. "We want a guarantee of no return to the shape-up," he said, "an end to the haphazard hiring of men, favoritism for a few, for the loading and discharging of ships. The seafaring men will no longer tolerate being handled like derelict slaves by the shipowners." The vast audience greeted this with a ringing cheer, almost an ovation. There was no doubt who had the confidence of the public. Lapham had class and plenty of brass. In straightforward debate about the issues of the strike, however, he was no match for a stevedore like Bridges. The shipowners began to ask themselves if it wasn't wiser to give a little rather than losing all. The big press also changed its tone of hostility to the maritime unions. But the employers' negotiations haggled on until the first part of February 1937, when they finally signed new agreements. That was 4 months, 129 days, after the expiration of the old agreements with the unions. The men removed hatch covers from ships. Winches started lifting and lowering cargo, where stevedores sweated in ships' holds. The waterfront busted. Surely a harbinger of the Pacific Coast strike maritime strike also seemed to impel union action across the nation. The Eastern Seaboard seamen, the Gulf seamen, the auto workers' sit-downs, the great steel workers' struggle against Big Steel and its hired gunmen and police, and many more. The ferment of American workers grew and spread to build their unions and counter plans of employers to use depression-caused poverty to their own advantages. And that was, and I jumped over a few paragraphs, The Streamline Strike by James M. Jones. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.